Hello, and welcome to the Goolagatup Audio Walk. This walk follows the foreshore from Goolagatup to Applecross Jetty and takes about 40 minutes. Unlike other audio walks, you have two points to start from: at the top of the hill at Goolagatup by the path winding down to the river, or close to water level by the open ground beside the South of Perth Yacht Club. Once you've listened to the introduction, you'll be directed to the same spot at the edge of the river. So whichever starting point is most convenient, begin there. As you walk, you'll be directed to a landmark where you can listen to the next story. When the directions are finished, you'll be asked to press pause and move to the next landmark. Just to make things easier, when each story has finished, you'll hear a bell. That's the signal that you're about to hear directions to the next landmark. Some are quite close to each other, and the directions are simple, but others will need a turn on the footpath. On this walk, there's a couple of horror stories, a scandal, some young heroes, and one resident we should all take time to admire among other glimpses into the past. Goolagatup is a Noongar word meaning place of the children. Prior to colonisation, this area was the site for Noongar ceremonies, and the Bealeah Noongar would communicate with the Whadjuk people using fires from the heights. In 1801, Francois Harrison and a team from the Baudin expedition sailed up the Swan. They saw the entrance to the Canning, which Harrison named the Moreau, after midshipman Charles Moreau. In 1827, when James Stirling first entered the Swan River, another midshipman, George Heathcote, jumped ashore here, and Point Heathcote became the official name until just a few years ago, when it was formally changed back to Goolagatup. On the subject of names, we're in Applecross, named after a peninsula in Strathcarran, the Highlands of Scotland. This is one of several Scottish names, Perth being another, that Stirling bestowed on areas in or close by the Swan River colony. This led to an argument carried out in the local newspapers and correspondence, where English settlers complained at the proliferation of Scottish names. Stirling also considered the point here to be the best site to locate the capital, until he changed his mind in favour of the present site across the river. Others still thought Point Heathcote was a much better choice. They were overruled. However, it isn't clear. If this promontory was the site of the new capital, would it be named Perth or Heathcote? While you're pondering that, walk either down from the Art Centre or along the pedestrian path to the beachfront. Then follow the path a short distance to a modern timber bench with some descriptive panels. Sit if you want, while I tell you about the geological forces that shaped this part of the river. Goolagatup is at the confluence of the Swan and Canning rivers, which probably joined up less than 60,000 years ago, though the landscape before you is better understood as the result of nearly 200 years of human alteration. If you came here before 1827, the year midshipman George Heathcote jumped ashore and became the first European on record to set foot at the point, the shape of the promontory would be familiar, though almost everything else has changed. Much of this walk would have been densely wooded, with paper barks, peppermints, and some jarrah making sections impassable or difficult to get through. While you might get a sense of that following the path around the foot of the hospital grounds, a lot of the plant life lining the path that you now see has been introduced, intentionally or otherwise. The Noongar inhabitants knew what a great resource confluences are. Shaped by currents, they create a fertile topography. Sandbars for nesting birds, stagnation zones preferred by cobbler and flathead, and the meeting of the currents that tailor, mulloway and herring that have come in from the ocean prefer. Shellfish thrive in estuaries too. Mussels and clams in the Swan, and if you're around in the 1960s, you'll remember the Oyster Beds restaurant around the bend in East Fremantle, which was on the site of an old oyster farm. The shallows around the shoreline are recent, created by dredging for the Canning Bridge and other infrastructure. In the past, paperbarks and peppermints would have hung over deeper waters, snarled with fallen branches and tree trunks, making this a paradise for fish, and then for the birds, the reptiles and the mammals that fed off them. With several geographic features to attract a variety of animals and plants, think of Coolagatup as a large and never-ending storehouse of food. From this point, the path closely follows the foreshore. Follow it along to the Whalen Bay Scout Hall, where I'll tell you some of the history of Heathcote Hospital. If you go to the website wanowandthen.com, you can find a short and very watchable documentary, Heathcote Asylum, The Untold Story, produced by Ken Kelso and presented by Richard Offen. At one point, Mr. Kelso, whose mother was a patient several times in the 1960s, describes looking at the promontory at the junction of the Canning and the Swan, the bushland, the modernist glass mansions, the yachts on the water, and seeing a landscape not of sunlight and affluence, but loaded with grim associations. It's a reminder of the presence this site has on the history of Perth. Though the hospital closed in 1994 and the buildings were given a makeover, erasing the tangible evidences of wards and clinics, you may still feel their presence as you walk through. It's also a reminder of the stigma that mental illness still carries. Despite all the progress in diagnosis and treatment, we don't really understand how or why people fall ill. So we're frightened by the apparent randomness of illnesses like schizophrenia as much as their incurability. To understand the history of Heathcote Hospital, and if along the way you're wondering why the hospital was built on some of the most desirable land in Perth, it helps to start at the Fremantle Arts Centre in 1861, when the colony's first psychiatric institute opened. The thick stone walls, the iron bars across the windows. This wasn't a time or a place where psychiatric illnesses were intended to be cured. The approach back then was still to lock people away, out of sight, out of mind. But the 1860s marks the beginning of the end of that system. By the 1880s, neurologists like Charcot in Paris are thinking that illnesses like hysteria can be, if not actually cured, then brought under control. They're also realising that environmental surroundings play a big part in this. To keep people calm, place them in calming environments, like parks and woodlands. Think of the Greylands complex. When work began on that in the 1900s, it was located at the edge of the city, still out of sight, but nothing except bush between it and the sea. Go forward a couple of decades to July 1929, where, superbly situated on Point Heathcote, an eminence between Canning Bridge and Applecross, stands the government reception home for persons suffering from mental and nervous disorders, which, if environment is a curative factor, should achieve a record unique among institutions of its kind. And that wasn't all. Commanding broad views up and down the Swan River, with the skyline of Perth and Mount Eliza silhouetted to the east and the highlands of Nedlands to the north and west, its situation could hardly be excelled for sheer beauty. It has tranquility also, since no main road runs very close to it and bush surrounds it. So, a wonderful location for people needing their mental and nervous disorders cured. A shame, though, about some of those cures. Into the 1960s, homosexuality was treated as a mental illness. Worldwide, including at Heathcote, aversion therapy was the standard treatment. A patient sat in a chair with electrodes strapped to his leg and was shown pictures on a screen of women in swimsuits or men working out. As he lingered on the image of the man lifting weights, he received an electric shock. Eventually, he was supposed to realise that looking at an image of a woman in bikinis was much better for him. You might think we've come a long way in the last 50 years. But bear in mind that while WA has introduced moves to change the law, it hasn't yet. As of December 2023, banned conversion therapy, of which aversion therapy is just one aspect. Depression has been diagnosed as a mental illness since the 19th century, but very poorly understood. So treatments ranged from fatherly advice to man up to electric shock therapy. If you are suffering noticeable signs of depression, lassitude, social isolation, inability to concentrate, but not considered a danger to yourself or others, you would have been sent to Heathcote rather than Greylands, where you would most likely be put on a course of antidepressants. Some of these were also only vaguely understood, and it's still debatable whether patients who took their own lives were reacting to the illness or its supposed cure. Another dubious treatment was insulin coma, or insulin shock therapy for schizophrenia. A patient undergoing or prone to psychotic episodes was given extremely high doses of insulin over the course of a week or more, ultimately putting them into a diabetic coma. Developed by Austrian doctor Manfred Sekel in the 1920s, it was adopted at Heathcote in the late 1930s or early 1940s. Nurses at Heathcote reported that some patients showed remarkable improvement, which isn't surprising. Coma isn't sleep or mere unconsciousness. It's a deeper state where the patient can be unresponsive to sudden sharp pain, yet they can also report that they hear everything around them, including the doctor's frank assessments. It could be expected that a patient prone to psychotic episodes will emerge from an induced coma seemingly calmer, because anyone would. But it doesn't mean they have improved. It took a generation before medical boards acknowledged that once normal insulin levels were restored, the psychosis returned. By the early 1960s, it was discredited and abandoned. These attitudes and approaches were active and in some cases approved of by medical boards in our lifetimes. So it isn't surprising that a new generation of psychiatrists and psychologists still meet resistance when they introduce new theories to practice. One thing that's becoming clearer is that psychosis and other mental health issues have causes. Whether it's personal trauma or environmental conditions or chemical imbalance, as we get closer to understanding the cause of illnesses, we're learning that there are many more effective ways of dealing with them than brute force. Julia Crook has published a history of Heathcote Hospital based on interviews with former staff, and you can find that at the State Library. Follow the path along the river on your right, the Strand on your left, to the lone tree with a bench underneath. Have a seat there and listen to the tale of a scandal involving one of the most powerful politicians in the state at that time. Press pause now. One night in 1937, a chauffeur-driven car pulls into Heathcote Hospital and a man alights from the back seat. He goes to the front entrance and the door opens. A woman wearing a casually tied robe lets him in. So far, so what, you say? But the man was William Kitson, the Chief Secretary of WA. A role only just below the Premier in terms of importance, and the woman was Mildred Shawcross, matron at the hospital, and that scene, as reported by witnesses, will become central to the 1938 Royal Commission into Heathcote Mental Reception Home. It was established to look into the running of the hospital, particularly under Matron Shawcross. But like a lot of royal commissions, it uncovered much more, which, by the way, is why opposition parties always demand them and governments turn a deaf ear. 67 witnesses were called. The accusations of maladministration originally aimed at Mildred Shawcross spread across the hospital into the Department of Health, which Kitson, as Chief Secretary, was partly responsible for, and involved allegations that there was a power struggle between Heathcote and Claremont hospitals. The original incident, the firing and reinstatement of Shawcross, was entirely an in-house issue that the Department of Health could have and should have handled. But as these things often transpire, it rapidly metastasized into questions as to how public health was managed in the state. And of course, was the Chief Secretary really having an affair with the matron? Mildred Shawcross wasn't popular. Her own administration team claimed she was mentally unstable and frequently pitted staff against each other. Indeed, her only loyal friend in the whole affair was the Under-Secretary for Health, A.O. Neville, whose direction in the forced removal of Aboriginal children from their families has cast a stain upon the state. Still, unpopularity, or for that matter, being friends with A.O. Neville, wasn't in itself cause for her removal. Indeed, some of the evidence, especially from the chauffeur, suggests that if anyone was out of order, it was Kitson. Stories that on several evenings, the chauffeur would stop by the Leopold Hotel, where Kitson bought bottles of emu bitter before ordering him on to the hospital, were bad. And this while Mrs. Kitson was recuperating at home with a broken leg. That last detail should have been reason enough at least to send Kitson to the back bench. And this shouldn't really come as a surprise. Throughout the hearings, the real villain was always Mildred Shawcross. Here's a report of her court appearance from The Mirror, WA's tabloid scandal sheet of the day, from October 15, 1938. Very tall and slim, Miss Shawcross has a shock of auburn hair that just curled rebelliously from under her black-headed toque hat. She wore horn-rimmed spectacles. Her blue costume was girdled by a black belt, and flesh-coloured stockings and black shoes set off a neat ensemble. It reads like she came into court looking for trouble. But here's the thing. The hearings revealed chronic power imbalances in the system. The matron and her nurses, almost all women, were at the front line in medical care. Yet decisions on their relationship with patients and how they should act in unusual situations were being made by men with no experience in nursing. When those men, the superintendents and resident medical officers, were absent, which was frequently, snap decisions had to be made by the matron, but then she would be accused of overstepping her authority. It isn't entirely cynical to say the winner in this whole affair was the local press, who got 2 months of scandal and sensation to report on. Well, another winner was Kitson, who kept his job and eventually scored the plum post of Agent General in London. One of those roles you could say suited a retired gent with time on his hands and love of the theatre who'd like an apartment in the middle of London paid for by the government. Mildred Shawcross was fired and left the state. The other losers were the patients. The chance to improve bureaucratic and health practices was lost, and another wouldn't occur for decades. Keep following the path to the next bench, or the one after if you want. There's quite a few on this stretch of the river, and keep your eyes peeled. You might catch a sight of our next subject. Press pause now. As you follow the path around, you'll pass signs alerting you to keep an eye out for ospreys. There are osprey nests along the river to Guildford and along the Perth coastline. So if you've spent any time on the river or the coast or visited Rottnest in the last few years, you most likely have seen them. You may even think the birds are as natural a part of the landscape as magpies and ravens. And they are, sort of. The Noongar people call the osprey Yundurdu, evidence it was a presence on the landscape before colonisation. But by the 1980s, osprey and their nests weren't seen on the river. They disappeared, hunted by those people who insisted, despite all evidence, that the bird was a threat to their livelihood, but more profoundly, driven out by falling fish stocks. Their absence from the riverbanks was a measure of the river's health. Algal blooms kill fish, which make up 95% of an osprey's diet. But effluent pumped into the river by factories or through drains was much more destructive. Beginning in the 1980s, the cleanup of the river was taken seriously, with frequent testing and monitoring of levels. Today, seasonal algal blooms are still a problem. But as wetlands along the river are being restored, the river system is gradually becoming cleaner. The return of ospreys is one measure of the success of that program. So, what about these birds? Sometimes called seahawks, though they're not hawks, and sometimes called sea eagles, which are a different bird and have a distinctly different shape. Ospreys, Pandion haliatus, are their own species of raptor. They're neither hawks, eagles, owls, kites, or falcons. And the bird you see around here is Pandion cristatus, the largest subspecies of the osprey. Though some ornithologists argue it should be classified as a separate species altogether, to Pandion haliatus. While it is smaller than the common osprey seen in Europe and America, its most striking difference is that it's non-migratory. With Australia's mild winters, there's never been that need to fly south for the sun, so they don't. Unlike their northern cousins, who like to head to Mexico or Africa before the cold sets in. There are other features that make the osprey unusual. With most birds, the male is bigger and has the colours, while the female is small and drab by comparison. Female ospreys, however, are larger than the males, and their coloration is very similar to the males. Another big difference between ospreys and other raptors is their reversible rear talon. As it dives down, the osprey turns its talon around, creating a kind of claw to snatch fish from just below the surface. The fish they catch can be tailor or mulloway, weighing more than the osprey, which would be physically impossible without that movable talon. Or their other remarkable feature, barbs on the soft pad of their claws that help grip their prey. The success rate with catching fish is very high. One in four dives will bring up a fish, and the time they spend hunting, circling above the water, searching for the telltale glint of scales, is under 15 minutes, which in the animal kingdom is no time at all. Generally, ospreys mate for life, twice a year producing clutches of two or at the most three chicks. Children need a home, but osprey nests can be mansions. If left alone, ospreys will continue to build their nest over their lifetime, adding sticks and twigs to what can already be one of the largest and messiest nests in the bird world. That nest may be inherited by one of the chicks, which continue to build it and pass it on to their children, who do the same. Some osprey nests have been estimated to be over 100 years old, so four or five generations may use the same nest until its size forces it to fall apart. Here on the Swan, the repopulation of ospreys is too fresh for the huge nests you can find at Rottnest, but come back in half a century and see how big they are then. The best time to see ospreys in flight or fishing is early morning or late afternoon, though if you know where a nest is, you can observe them at home throughout the day. If you do see an osprey diving for fish or flying off with one in its beak, it will most likely be the male. Females do hunt, but during the laying season and nest building, they stay closer to home. Several organisations map and monitor osprey nests on the river and publish locations online. The Department of Biodiversity, Conservation and Attractions has also built artificial nests at nearby Point Whalen and other sites, if you do want to see one. We're nearly at the jetty now. Walk past the tennis courts to the next bench, and I'll tell you about some remarkable teenage girls who drew thousands of Perth citizens out to watch in the early part of the last century. Press pause now. Back in 1970, Sir Paul Hasluck, the Perth-born Governor-General of Australia, wrote that Canberra spent millions beautifying its waterways, while Perth spent millions destroying its own. He might have had Dundas Point in mind. Not that it's been destroyed, but when you look at some of the proposals, knocking down the Federation-style majestic hotel and replacing it with a 30-storey complex, building a massive marina and other schemes, it has come perilously close. There will always be people who, when confronted by a scene of natural beauty, immediately contemplate ways to make money from that, or in plain English, destroy it. Relatively little of the natural bush survives, and almost nothing of the colonial history either, but look closely, and there are clues. One of them is beside the jetty. The original jetty, long gone now, was built for the ferry trade. Before Canning Highway was sealed, and before the railways, before bridges even, ferries were the way to connect north and south of the river. Listen to the Melville audio walk for the story of the violence and skullduggery associated with the early ferry trade. The violence had quietened down by the turn of the century, but travellers still had good reasons to avoid the ferries, if they could help it. Here's a description of the average journey to Applecross from Fremantle in January 1907. A sovereign, by the way, was a coin worth £1. Fremantle citizens, if they could not afford the necessary sovereign for a horse and trap, had to first make their way to the Fremantle station, travel by train to Perth, trudge down to the William Street jetty, wait there for perhaps an hour, and then make a long water journey across to the Applecross jetty. People talk about a 3-hour journey into the city. There was an alternative, but it wasn't for everyone. Beginning in 1912 and going through to the 1920s, the Applecross to Barrack Street jetty swim held over the summer break attracted tens of thousands of spectators, lining the banks and crowding the waterways. Though the race started at 2:30, spectators were entertained throughout the morning and afternoon with picnics, rowing races and other events on land. Professional and amateur swimming champions offered advice to entrants on how to last the distance over 2.5 hours, but another detail in the reports brings the event into sharp relief. Prior to the race, the camera will be brought into requisition and the whole of the competitors will be taken in a group. The cinematographic camera will also be in evidence both at the start and finish and during the progress of the race. The first full-length cinema feature in the world was The Story of the Kelly Gang, made in Melbourne in 1906. This was only 6 years later, and the stilted language shows how new motion pictures still were. Actually, most people went to the cinema in those days to watch local street scenes and sporting events like the swim, because in the cast of thousands, they were hoping to see themselves, or family, or friends on the big screen. But I think the most interesting detail has to do with the entrance. To give you an idea of where we're heading, here's a quote from Boulder's Evening Star. Bear in mind that with over 100 people of all ages competing, the race was handicapped. Immediately following the chime of 2:30, Miss E. Ewart, on limit, 45 minutes, took a header off the Applecross jetty, and her splash into the waters was marked by a ringing cheer from the thousands of eager spectators on the bank. Enid Ewart, who was 13, didn't win that year, but she did finish, and Phyllis Bardwell, a couple of years older, came fourth. In the 1914 event, 13-year-old Alice Harbin did win, and Enid Ewart came third. In 1916, 14-year-old Stella Spicer of Netherlands won. In 1923, Miss Nelson from Geraldton won, and second and third places were won by teenage girls who'd gained places in earlier carnivals. These girls were beating bigger, stronger men. So often, we need to wonder why. One answer is that Stella Spicer, Enid Ewart, and others live close by the Swan, swam in it when they could, and had what you might call a hometown advantage. And remember, into the 1920s, probably most people in WA couldn't swim, at least over long distances. But another reason, I think, has to do with probably the most famous Australian in the world at that time, Annette Kellerman, champion swimmer, film star, and all-round rule-breaker. One of the rules Ms. Kellerman broke had to do with her swimsuit and how much of her body it covered. As a professional swimmer, she had no patience with the long, frilly outfits women were supposed to wear. Not only did she design her own costumes, they caught on. But what really held young girls' attention was the sport she invented, synchronized swimming. To be strictly accurate here, she didn't invent synchronized swimming, but she did make it a popular sport. If boys had Les Darcy, a rough, brawling boxer for a hero, girls had Annette Kellerman, graceful, balletic, and never concerned how others thought she should conduct herself. Nearly at the end now. Let's walk to the jetty. If the tide is low, pay attention to those wooden structures on your right. Press pause now. By the 1930s, Applecross Jetty was a place to head to in your yacht or tinny on a Sunday afternoon, to sit on the lawn below the majestic hotel and share the view with a drink or two, not to mention any human friends you'd magically collected when you'd announced you'd bought the boat. Photographs from the first half of last century show the jetty has undergone substantial changes. Originally, there were two arms at the end, one with a shed. Large ferries used to cross the river and the shed would have held ropes and other equipment for berthing. Possibly it was a waiting room for passengers needing somewhere to sit. When the tide is low and you're standing at the beginning of the jetty, behind you and to your right is a sequence of wooden structures, baffle boards installed in the 1990s to inhibit erosion, itself a product of redevelopment of the foreshore. At the beginning of the jetty, so to your left and right, is an older structure that may have been part of the extensions where the shed sat, or possibly a barrier preventing ferries and other boats from running aground. No one's really sure, but they're reminders that 100 years ago, Applecross Jetty was a hive of activity. It's worth thinking, what would have happened had Stirling got his way and built the capital at Goolagattup? We wouldn't be standing here looking at the old Heathcote Hospital, but Government House or Parliament House, and being much closer to the port and following the river's edge, almost certainly this belt between Goolagattup and the port would be a mix of commercial and industrial. The problems facing engineers, the sandbars especially, could be dealt with easily enough, but the consequences of their work would be felt today. The flow of water, silt, nutrients, and other elements would be profoundly altered. Palmyra would most likely be an industrial heartland, and don't assume no one was that crazy to remove all of Applecross for the sake of a deep water station. The thing about silly ideas is that there's always somebody willing to put them into motion. So if you'd like to hear more from the history of the city of Melville and the riverfront, there's another Melville audio walk focusing on Point Walter. Dr. Noel Nanup, OAM, provided the cultural advice. The audio was mixed and recorded at Fremantle Recording Studios. Thanks to the City of Melville for providing funding for this project. Many of the stories in these audio walks have the beginning at Trove, the online database owned by the National Library of Australia. It's one of this country's great public resources, and we will be poorer without it. Talk to you at the next walk.